And welcome, welcome, welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and this program comes your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at those times at richarddugan.com. Also available as a podcast at the radio show's page of richarddugan.com, SoundCloud, and iTunes. That is correct. We do have Facebook and Twitter. Yeah, we use it sort of, kind of, in a way, to try It's hard because there's so much going on. There's so much happening. There's so much to do. And that's just with my full-time job. Although I would love to make this my full-time job, doing this radio program, bringing these special guests to you who have information that I think will assist you in the process of your evolutionary movement forward, if you will, your evolution. And we're going to be talking about that as well. Talking about a couple of subjects that are tied together very eloquently, I think, by our special guest, Cindy Warren. And I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program as we get set to meditate, om, and a namaste to you too.
Hello, Richard. It's such a pleasure to be here with you.
I have to say that I am not a meditator of the traditional sense. I adhere to the phrase of, I believe it was either Teresa Neumann or Teresa of Avila, who said that God is among the pots and the pans. So when I'm amongst the pots and the pans, that's kind of when I'm meditating. Or in my case, the peripherals and the digits, or decimals, or whatever the case may be.
Excellent. Yeah. I can see that.
And some days it's easier than others. I am lucky that I am working with someone who has instituted a system of checks and balances to where if I miss it, he'll catch it. If he misses it, I'll catch it. And it kind of goes through that filter maybe twice or three times just to make sure that, you know, even the smallest stuff, you know, I've always believed it's the details that'll make you or break you, not the big stuff. It's the details.
Very true.
So you have your latest work. We'll also be giving out, ladies and gentlemen, her web address in just a few moments here. Your latest work is a book called Radiate, and it is not radiate like radiator, R-A-D-I, and the number 8. There's a name for words like that, and I can't think of what it is. Be that as it may, very cute. Using the practice of yoga to cultivate your inner shine. I like that. That's very, very, very nice. Like I said, I'm not a real big meditator, and I'm about as limber as it gets at the age of 58, which is not bad. I'm not a fan of deprecation, let alone self-deprecation. So I try not to do that to myself and hopefully encourage people not to do that to themselves, because we need to speak kindly of ourselves. That's part of, I think, our evolutionary process as well. We need to start looking at the good that's within us and seeing the good that's in other folks. But you, we're not talking to you from somewhere in the middle of India in some ashram somewhere, which is rather interesting because I would have expected that based upon your background. But you're sitting somewhere in the middle of Cleveland, Ohio? Really?
Correct.
The heart of yoga country, right?
Exactly. Just as the yogis envisioned it.
I know there's a prophecy somewhere in the Vedas. But you pattern your practice and what it is that you teach others from a particular source. And it's not the Kama Sutra. It's not the Bhagavad Gita. I want to say it's Patanjali's Yoga Sutras.
Yes, very good. Absolutely, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras.
And it's very interesting because this kind of information has been around for centuries. And it seems like it's only now really, I mean, here we are in the 21st century. And of course, I'm familiar with Paramahansa Yogananda and his bringing these philosophies to the U.S., to the West. Mm-hmm. But that was sort of an interim process. And here we are, the 21st century, and Eastern philosophy is, and I'm using that as a very broad term, is really permeating our society today. I mean, I know that mindfulness is sort of a sort of, in a way, a Western construct, but it's derived from the Eastern philosophies, as is yoga and meditation.
All very true. Very true.
So tell me, how did this all begin for you? Why are these particular practices, in particular yoga and meditation, which again do go hand in hand, why are they so important and of a concern to you that you need to not just practice it yourself? Because that would be fine. You know, hey, you're doing great. You're having a great time in your life. But now you want to share it with the rest of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to just speak a little bit about my own journey with the practice. I started practicing yoga about 15 years ago. And where I live in Cleveland, Ohio, and I think in most parts in the United States and in the West in general, yoga is sort of generally conceived as another form of physical exercise. And it is that. And it is so much more. In fact, in the Yoga Sutras, which is one of the, if not the preeminent text of yoga philosophy, Patanjali lays out an 8-part path. Or 8 limbs, as he calls them, which explains the title of my book, Radiate, using the number 8. So as I got more into the practice myself, I was just a voracious student for well over a decade before I even thought about becoming a teacher. And now that I've been a teacher of yoga, as well as a student for many years, I decided that I felt there was a lacking in the market. People weren't understanding that yoga is so much more than just physical practice. I was seeing this among my contemporaries, my students, and it inspired me to write what I hope is a kind of accessible way to look at yoga philosophy in the larger context of what that means and how it can help us, as you said, Richard, with our own personal or spiritual evolutions.
Well, let me ask you about your personal and or spiritual evolution, and specifically spiritual, where did you hail from originally as a child growing up with your family, and how what was the evolutionary process that brought you to where you are today?
I grew up outside of Hartford, Connecticut, in a reform to conservative Jewish home. So I was raised in kind of a traditional American Jewish way, which was not very religious, but somewhat into holidays and rituals and that sort of thing. And I never really felt a sense of spirituality around my religion or tradition. It wasn't until I really started practicing yoga in my 30s, I'm now in my mid-40s, in my early 30s, late 20s, that I felt like I felt there was a spiritual connection there. Ironically, after a few years of practice, that actually drove me to look deeper into the spiritual roots of Judaism. And I did explore that for a few years before I really came full circle and decided that for me, the spiritual path that I walk and teach is yoga.
Okay. And when you've been practicing for how many years, specifically yoga?
About 15, 16 years. Yeah, something like that.
And the companion to that, meditation?
Yes.
About the same?
Meditation is, yeah, exactly. Meditation is not taught in most yoga studios, but pretty within the first couple of years of my enjoyment of the physical practice, I learned how to meditate and became a student of meditation as well. It's really only within the last few years that I've consistently maintained a daily practice and also become certified to teach mindfulness-based meditation. And that has been a very important part of my spiritual journey.
I remember when I first started hearing about meditation and what it was, how you were supposed to meditate. And one of the aspects was to clear the mind, just, you know, like a chalkboard, just wipe all of the chalk off of the chalkboard so all you see is green or black, whatever your color is of your chalkboard. and then just let all that, just clear it, shut it down, so to speak, turn it off if you could, and then you just let the third eye, you let the inner imagination, you let your intuition, that inner voice, the divine self, the higher self, again, a myriad of different names, come in. And it was several years after that that I started hearing that that's not what you want to do. Because what you're telling your mind is, you are not welcome here. And I was told that you want to actually embrace your mind and just ask it in a participatory way of sorts. Could you just kind of go over here and just sit quietly for just a few minutes, okay? I don't want to ignore you. It's like a little child, right? I don't want to ignore you, but I need this time, and I would really appreciate it if you would just sit quietly so that I can go over here and do this thing, and I'll come back to you. I promise, you know, kind of thing.
That's a fantastic description. I think many, many people are under the misimpression that meditation means you close your eyes, clear your head, and divine consciousness or what have you enters. And that's not really the way it works at all. In mindfulness meditation, you're absolutely right. The goal is not to be in a state of no mind or a complete dearth of thinking. It's rather to have a focal point, whether it's the breath or a mantra, and to use that as a way to center you while you almost observe the meanderings of your mind. Not tell the mind it can't wander, but cultivate a little bit of distance between you, the observer, the witness, the seer, and the wanderings of the mind.
And so also another initial instruction was that you had to get yourself a mat or a pillow, and you sit in the lotus posture, legs crossed, hands out on the knees, palms up with the thumb and the forefinger on each hand touching. Close your eyes. Move your eyes up to the third eye. I mean, there was this whole structural thing going on, right?
Yes.
And now, as I said, that phrase, God is amongst the pots and the pans, and I will get into that zone, as you hear in sports quite often. Whether I'm doing production, whether I am working out in the yard, working in the garden, working with the dogs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And especially, most especially, working out in nature. Again, with the dogs, the cats, we have chickens, we have deer on the property, we used to have wild chickens, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that always was, and to me, that is, that can be, I should say, a form of meditation. I live here in Santa Barbara, so I could walk along the beach, the same kind of thing. You don't necessarily have to be sitting still. Again, it goes back to that whole issue of the structure. And so there is no, from your perspective, there is no set structure that one needs to follow, even though you probably do have some steps that would be helpful to folks to consider.
I think that's right. I love what you said about the pots and the pans. In fact, Thich Nhat Hanh, one of the great spiritual thinkers of our day, a Tibetan Buddhist, wrote a book on, I forget the name of it, but he does talk about meditating while you're literally washing the dishes. You're washing the dishes, and you know that you're washing the dishes. So it's a way of being present. You find that in nature with your chickens, with your dogs. Yeah, that's meditation. And then you're correct. In addition to that, there are some steps that I typically take when I sit down to meditate, but you don't have to sit. You certainly don't need to sit in the lotus position. And I think meditation and mindfulness meditation in particular can be so much more accessible, simple, and easy than we often make it out to be.
Yeah, and that to me is one of the things in a lot of areas of life, not just meditation, that I know a lot of folks they get stuck in. Now, for example, when I train people in my line of work, broadcasting, when I take them in and I say, okay, you want to learn how to do this, okay, what I do is I say, I'm going to show you how I do it, okay, and I'm going to tell you the result that we want. And then when I set you loose to do your to do what it is I've shown you to do, I then want you to find your way of getting the result that I've asked for. And that seems to work well. So what is the result that we are looking for in meditation, if we can put it in that context?
Yeah, I think we can. I would say there are two. The first is just simply what I mentioned a moment ago. Becoming and learning to be in the present moment, which seems very simple, but is quite hard to do. So that's one. The second that I think is perhaps even more understandable and practical for people is learning to create space between what arises in our minds and how we react to it. So creating space between stimulus and response. A negative emotion arises, and instead of immediately getting into a cycle of negative emotion, can we step back, observe, create a little space, and then make a decision about how we want to respond to whatever it is that's arisen internally?
When you are ready to take that, set that time aside, and I would venture you probably do have a fairly set time every day that you sit down to either practice yoga or to get into that meditative state. And again, you may be doing both at the same time. I know that in some philosophies, there are practices that they are asked to do. Sometimes they use the term required to do 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 times a day, that type of stuff. What about your perspective in terms of any kind of guidelines or guidance? Let's put it that way, guidance that you can give for people maybe who are just starting out or who have been doing it for a long time, but they feel a frustration, which is sort of the opposite of what you want to achieve with both of these, to help help us to find those spaces. You know, we can't do it while we're driving per se, okay? Mm-hmm. But how can you guide us along through this process so that we can at least minimize the frustration?
I think my answer is going to be different for people that are wanting to start a meditation practice and for seasoned meditators who may be frustrated with their practice. And I'll start with the latter first. If you've been meditating for a long time and you feel like you're not getting what you want out of your practice or finding that space or that pause button or that ability to be more present, you should know there are as many types of meditation out there as there are flavors of ice cream. So a little bit of exploration can be helpful. I know a number of ways to meditate, and sometimes I use different techniques even during the same session. So it can be helpful to mix things up and perhaps find a skilled meditation teacher either near you or with the internet. Meditation teachers are a click away. For someone looking to start a practice, I think there is something to be said for consistency. And this doesn't have to be every day at 6 a.m. I sit for 30 minutes. It really doesn't have to be that at all. I think striving for a daily-ish practice as opposed to a daily practice might feel a little less oppressive for people. And personally, while I would love to have a time of day every day that I do my practice, my schedule, I juggle a few jobs, I have a family, I meditate when I can fit it in. So I have a daily practice of a 20-minute sit, ideally twice a day, but many days I only get one session in. But I think for newbies, 20 minutes is a really long time. You can sit, close your eyes, follow your inhale and your exhale for 4 rounds of breath. Open your eyes and voila, you just meditated. You could set a timer for a minute, 5 minutes, maybe work up to 10. But there's so many ways that you can just incorporate, whether it's 30 seconds, 60 seconds, 2 breaths, 10 breaths into your day, that's going to help you cultivate the skill we're looking to build in meditation.
Some terms that I'm going to ask you to talk to us about now as we continue here on the program. We're talking with the author of Radiate, Using the Practice of Yoga to Cultivate Your Inner Shine. And Cindy Warren is my guest, and we're going to talk a little bit now about yamas. Mm-hmm. Tell me about yamas.
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier, yoga is an 8-limb or 8-part path. Yamas is the first limb. And these are ethical guidelines, if you will, that govern how we are supposed to relate to the world around us.
Okay. How about niyamas?
Niyamas, that's limb number two. Mm-hmm. And there are five yamas and five niyamas. And the niyamas are practices that we can incorporate into our lives that help us with the relationship with ourselves. And the theory is that we're here to be of service to the world and to bring more loving kindness into the world. And it all really starts with our relationship with ourselves. So the niyamas focus on that relationship in particular.
And then there is, I think it's referred to as the physical pose, asanas.
Yes, asana is the physical practice. The literal translation of asana is seat or posture. And asana is what most modern practitioners of yoga do. Take their sticky mat to their local yoga studio, roll it out, hit a down dog, a few other poses. That's asana.
I'm going to jump down here because this is the one aspect that I know that the listeners who are wanting to, and again, I realize that the word achieve is sort of inappropriate in one context, because when you're practicing yoga and or doing meditation, it's not about achieving anything. It's kind of like the Buddha who was seeking enlightenment, and it wasn't until he sat down under the Bodhi tree, he's going, oh yeah, if I stop looking for it, I'll find it.
Exactly.
Which is counterintuitive, but you have the samadhi, the ability to achieve an enlightened potential of deep connection.
Right. Samadhi is the final of the eight limbs. It translates as enlightenment. And there are some yoga teachers or yogis out there who will say it's really not possible for almost all of us to achieve an enlightened state. My take on samadhi is that it's a little more accessible. I think of it as something that we can get glimpses of, find pockets of in our lives or in our days. And for me, it really is tapping into this idea that whatever there's obviously a lot of diversity among us, but there's a commonality deep inside of each of us. That's what we bow to when we say namaste at the end of a yoga class, or what we salute when we chant an om at the beginning or end of a class. And it's really the thing that you can think of as being the source of the world or divine consciousness, or there are a million ways to think of it. And it's simply the part of us that's connected to the part that exists in everything else in this world.
This is, this goes beyond, this is great stuff. This really is, because it does not, again, doesn't have to be complicated, doesn't have to be arduous. And again, you don't want it to be, because then you end up generating more stress than you have to work off through the yoga and meditation. And so it's like, you don't want to create a problem and then use the solution that you were supposed to use to eliminate the problem you had in the first place.
Right.
We're going to continue talking more about this. Radiate, and that is the title of the book. We also would like you folks to go to, and I'm going to pull that up right now. It's right here, and it happens to be, the website is yogaforyourbestlife. I said that slowly because you're going to want to take that down. yogaforyourbestlife.com. You can not only find out more about Cindy, but you can also find out more about the book and the work that she does. You work with people long distance as well?
I do.
All right. Well, we'll let our listeners know more about that as we continue here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, along with Cindy Warren, and we're talking about her book and her work that she's been doing for quite a long time. Has there been for you a sort of a predisposition, if you will, to embrace these concepts and ideas, or does this go back to your upbringing because of your Jewish tradition? Because it's a much older tradition, shall we say, than say my upbringing of Catholicism.
Yeah, I think the answer is probably yes to both aspects of that. I've always been a curious person and someone who loves to learn. So when I started to explore, for example, the spiritual aspects of Judaism. It was almost more from an intellectual perspective than a spiritual one. So I love learning more about different kinds of traditions. And I think I have a natural proclivity toward anxiety and the sense of I must achieve. I was always that way as a student, and it really was more self-imposed than imposed by my family or anything of that nature. And I found these practices to really help me find the calm and stillness within that eluded me for the first few decades of my life. But I think I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge the fact that my Judaism may play a role in this. So many of our most well-known meditation teachers in America today come from Jewish backgrounds. In fact, there's a name for them, the Jubus, the Jews that have turned Buddhist. So there may be something to the idea that people with my heritage are seeking for something deeper, seeking for something more meaningful and yet accessible.
Now that's very interesting. And maybe there might be just a natural progression for this particular philosophy, Judaism, that you're predisposed, if you will, because you're open to these concepts. Whereas, unfortunately, with Christianity that I grew up with, and of course I worked for 15 years for a Christian radio station, and when yoga started to appear in the lexicon briefly and sparsely, there was an enormous amount of fear. It's Eastern, it's of the devil, and so on and so on and so on. You don't want to have anything to do with it. You're opening yourself up to blah, 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 blah. And I thought, wait a minute. You're trying to make the conclusion that Christianity came out of some vacuum somewhere. There isn't a philosophy on the planet that didn't derive its origins from what came before.
Correct.
And so there shouldn't be a fear or concern. And again, this goes back to, again, what we were saying about, being predisposed through the philosophy that you have. Because it seems to me, because I've interviewed a number of rabbis in particular, and the education they go through is just extraordinary. I love talking with them, the information that we share. And they just seem to be so, as educated as they are, and as rabbinical as they come across, which is wonderful, they're not closed off to considering possibilities. That's one of the things that I love. And so it seems to me that that's where you're at as well. Again, that predisposition, shall we say.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to be compared to studied rabbis.
Well, I am most appreciative of the fact that we're able to discuss these kinds of things, because some years back, again, going back in my case to the 80s and early 90s, it wasn't that way. You couldn't talk about certain things. And unfortunately, we're living in a time now where you have to be careful what you say to certain people, because unless you know their point of origin, you know, you could end up in a fight, or worse. Mm-hmm. And again, that's counterproductive, counterintuitive to what it is that we're talking about here as far as incorporating meditation. Let's talk about the yoga practice a little bit more here in terms of a lot of the newer stuff that's out there. Now, obviously, the traditional stuff, you'll sit in a particular posture if you choose to, and then we're going to put it in that context. And you're going to change positions throughout. I mean, and now there's this new one called hot yoga, mm-hmm. which I pass on. I'm from Phoenix, Arizona. Had enough of that. Had enough of hot. So I'll do cold yoga.
I passed on that one too. You're in good company.
Yeah. If you want to do cold yoga, like in a meat locker or something, I'm with you. Okay. Turn it down to 32. I'll wear a fleece sweatsuit. but talk to me about the evolution, at least in the West, of yoga and your perspectives on that, as far as its level of benefit and helpfulness for individuals that are practicing.
Sure. Yoga began in the East as a way to help students get their physical agitation out, if you will, so that they could sit in meditation. So the physical practice was really a means to an end, and meditation was considered the true practice of yoga. In the West, that's been turned on its head in some ways, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. The physical practice is extremely beneficial, and there are many teachers who believe that you can practice all aspects of yoga, each of the eight limbs, on your yoga mat. And I think there is something to be said for that. But in terms of the variety of physical practices available to the modern practitioner, they're as long as the day. So you can find, as you said, a hot yoga class. You can find a physically vigorous class. You can find something as gentle as yoga done in a chair. You can find something as playful as goat yoga.
Yeah.
So there is no end to the varieties. But what the practice is intended to do, and with a skilled teacher, whatever the context, will do, is work on the nervous system. So there's a lot of scientific basis for the physical, mental, and other benefits of the practice. And even in a physically vigorous class, which is the kind I like to practice myself and teach, you really do focus on the breath, focus on the internal sensations of the body. Slow down your mental chatter, even when the body is moving somewhat at a quicker pace. So there's a stilling and interiorization process that helps us switch out of the fight or flight response, which is the sympathetic nervous system, into what we call rest and digest, or the parasympathetic nervous system. And there's a tremendous amount of health benefits to be had by making that shift in the nervous system.
In are there particular postures or positions that because I'm familiar, of course, and I know I'm showing a little ignorance here in this respect to the difference between yoga postures and the Kundalini energy up through the spine, as taught by SRF and other philosophies. But are there particular positions that probably are better for people who have been practicing a while? That are more beneficial, let's say, in terms of keeping energy flow? Because I know that, for example, certain aches and pains in the body,
okay,
we could attribute those to I did this, I did that, I did the other thing, but it's more along the lines of there's a blockage of the energy flow and that needs to be opened up. So are there postures that can help to maintain that flow?
I think even more than a particular posture, it's how you move in the posture and from posture to posture.
Oh, okay.
So the physical alignment and engaging energetic locks in the body that are called bandhas that a skilled teacher can walk a student through, that's a way to open up the energy system in the body to clear blockages and to keep the body safe. So for example, a lot of not just yoga practitioners, but many modern Americans suffer from low back pain. And there are things that I see many students and even teachers do and teach that are not optimal for low back health, for lumbar health. So with good alignment and focusing on the energy systems via the bandhas, you really can improve energy flow and minimize pain and even chronic pain.
Talk to me about the connection between the eight-limbed path, as you've been describing. We touched upon a few of those earlier, and the seven chakras and their relationship there to yoga practice.
Sure. So chakras, and I think this was a little bit implied in your reference to Kundalini yoga, which opens up, which is concerned with energy centers along the spine.
Mm-hmm.
Chakras are considered to be energy centers along the spine, basically. And practitioners of yoga might hear a lot of talk about chakras, open your heart chakra, for example, or as you referenced when we were talking about meditation earlier, bring your awareness to your third eye. That's another chakra. So chakras aren't things that we can physically see, but they're, according to yoga philosophy, energy systems that if they're blocked, cause all sorts of emotional and physical problems. So the yoga, I think the chakras really work in tandem with the various eight limbs of yoga as a way to self-diagnose, self-heal. It's not something that is essential to having a good foundation of an asana practice or a meditation practice. It's almost icing on the top of the cupcake, I think about it as.
And are there parts of a yoga practice that one, we should, if we've never done it before, we need to start slow. You do not want to start in an intermediate class if you've never practiced before. And you certainly don't want to do some of these practices alone if you're going to try some of the more advanced kinds of things in that respect.
Absolutely. And I think the good news is, wherever your listeners are, there's probably a yoga studio within a 20-minute drive at the most. So finding a good skilled teacher and learning the basics and the fundamentals of the practice from someone with some good education, I think is really important. Now, personally, I love having a home yoga practice. So I do much of my practice at home alone. But I practiced in a studio setting for many years before I felt I could even guide myself safely through an effective practice. So I think it's very important for beginners to find a good teacher.
And in finding that good teacher, they could find that good teacher even in you if they wanted to get in touch with you through your website, I would take it?
Absolutely.
And of course, again, that website that we were referring to earlier, we encourage you to go there and check it out. But before I give that email address or that web address, I also want to ask you, I love this. You have a blog on your website, and I love some of the titles of some of the blogs. One in particular is, and I'm not really into this particular thing, but meditation latte, question mark?
Oh, I'm a latte girl. I love a good latte. So that blog was in reference to, as I said before, I know a number of techniques of meditation. And several months ago, perhaps 6 or 8 months ago, I learned a new technique. It's an ancient technique, but it was new to me. And it seemed to me to take my practice up a level. Like I got a good, almost caffeine buzz going from my meditation practice. So I wanted to introduce that to my readers. It's called Transcendental Meditation, colloquially known as TM. And it's a kind of meditation that many celebrities have latched onto for some reason, including Oprah and also all sorts of people. So it was something I felt I wanted to try. And it's a technique that I am really enjoying. And I view it as another tool in my meditation toolbox.
Talk to me about, let's add another layer to this. Talk to me about the role of the inner voice or your intuition. Mm-hmm. In either or both meditation and yoga?
I think those are two different things, the inner voice and intuition. So the inner voice, the way I think of it, is something that we all need to become aware of. So if you were to sit and still your body and close your eyes and just notice what was happening between your ears, you're almost certain to notice there's a running dialogue going on in there. It might be something as mundane as your grocery shopping list. It might be ruminations about the past, worries about the future. But it is the nature of the mind to just have this inner dialogue with itself. So the inner voice is something that we can start to listen to through meditation and yoga. And then we can actually develop the skill to change the way we talk to ourselves in our own head. So I, for example, I mentioned that I think I have a natural tendency toward anxiety. And for many, many years, I had an extremely critical inner voice. And it wasn't until I was firmly rooted in my yoga and meditation practice that I became almost friends with this voice and then could rewire it. So I think that's a really practical benefit of the practice. And then moving a little bit along the spectrum toward the esoteric, intuition is really what's there behind that inner chatter. So I think tapping into our intuition, and some people naturally are more in touch with their intuition than others. I don't think I'm a naturally intuitive person, so I have to work a little bit to quiet the mind, get still, and then really intuit what's around me and who's around me and what the energy is like. But it's something that I think is a beautiful result of deepening that inward journey that is yoga and meditation.
I think that more and more people are getting into this practice. They're finding it quite beneficial. What are, from your perspective as both a practitioner as well as a teacher of both of these, what do you see as the biggest benefits for an individual in taking on a yoga practice that then could certainly lead into maybe more meditation and, yeah, and self-reflection and help that evolutionary process along?
I think the main benefits are actually, apart from the physical benefits, of which there are many and which are highlighted in our modern media a lot, I think the main benefits are developing the skill to slow down, to develop a kinder and more loving relationship with yourself, and then literally learning to radiate that out into the world, bringing a little more love, a little more kindness and compassion to those around us. To me, that's really the bottom line beauty and accessibility of the practice, and something I think our world needs a lot right now.
I would agree with you on that, absolutely. We're having a lot of difficulty just coexisting, let alone communicating with one another. And we could use all the help we can get in that regard. Because we're, you know, I've often said this on this program that, you know, if the good Lord intended it for us all to live solitary lives, I would venture there are enough Class M planets in the universe, each of us, 7.6 billion people. Yeah, you caught that reference, did you? Each of us would be able to live on a separate planet. But what is the reality? 7.6 billion people reside on the same ball of dust. And it seems to me that that indicates to me we're supposed to work together. We're supposed to live together. We're supposed to play together, find a way to coexist and so forth in spite of what are perceived differences. And I have to say that I really believe that that's what it is. They're perceived differences because we choose to make them differences.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that the philosophy and practice of yoga can cut through that and bring us to our commonality.
I don't think any of us are going to see in any time in the near future our president sitting in the lotus posture. That isn't going to happen.
I think so.
Although I would even go back two or three or four or five presidents and say the same thing. I don't think we'd see them in the lotus posture.
You're right.
Obama, which is unfortunate.
Maybe. I could see him in lotus.
which is unfortunate because it would do him or whoever's elected in the future, him or her, it would do them a world of good and probably do the world a world of good as well, with greater focus and concentration, if you will.
That's
a good point, too, because we do tend to do that, don't we? We tend to react rather than to act.
Right.
Talk to us about how these practices can help us to stay in that focus of acting.
Well, it's that moment you described, like the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree. He's sitting there waiting for something to come along and ruffle his feathers so that he can practice acting, not reacting. Mm. That's how the story goes, as I've learned it.
Yeah.
So when we practice yoga and meditation, we cultivate space. So something arises that triggers us, whether it's in our own minds or on the road or in our home or in our workplace. And instead of reacting, we learn the skill of pausing, reflecting, and then deciding in a skillful, loving way how we want to act.
Hmm. Tell me about your concept, if you will, your perception of yoga as you see it through the eyes of Michelangelo.
Michelangelo is rumored to have said that he didn't create David. What he said was, according to the story, David was there. He was there the whole time. All I did was chip away at the non-David in the stone. So I liken that to what yoga does for us as individuals. We're perfect as we are. We have everything we need inside of us. We have all the love and compassion. It's in there just by virtue of us being on this earth at this time. And what yoga can help us do is peel away the parts of us that are not those things that we are seeking to cultivate, that are not love and compassion and kindness and action as opposed to reaction. Yoga can help us shed that which really isn't serving us. Mm-hmm. And in that way, we come more into ourselves. So it's almost a process of elimination as opposed to addition.
You know, in the New Testament, there's a passage that reads, be perfect even as your Father in heaven is perfect. And back in the 80s, early 90s, I was pondering that, trying to figure out what the heck that meant. And this was just in my own head. I wasn't doing any research in any books or anything or talking with anybody else. And I came to this conclusion that the word perfect did not apply to the constructs of good and evil, light and dark, good and bad, right and wrong, because God is none of those things. God just is. So then I thought, okay, well, if that's the case, to be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect, as God is, means to just be. And what you just said is just that. If we just would allow ourselves to be, we're in that state of perfection, and then we can go through the process, as you've talked about, of chipping away those things that are not part of us, that we've actually layered upon ourselves as we've moved through this lifetime.
I love that. That is beautiful.
So what's next for you? I mean, this is a wonderful work. I mean, and it seems on the one hand to be a pretty simple thing to do for all of us. We've gotten the book Radiate, and we've gone to the website, and we've gotten to know you and all of this. So what's next for Cindy?
I'm really focused on growing as a teacher, as a student, as a meditator, continuing my own practice and doing what I can to teach others, because I think it's a practice that's been quite transformative for me and a lot of my students. I just want to continue to share it. I don't have any big, exciting plans other than that in the works right now. Mm.
Well, we're grateful for your participation in this program as well, and for also sharing these wonderful ideas with our listeners, who can go to the website yogaforyourbestlife.com, yogaforyourbestlife.com. You can certainly go to her blogs and read about another interesting title is The Yogic Approach to Goal Setting, which, again, as I mentioned earlier in the program, when you're practicing yoga or you're practicing meditation, the goal is more the practice than it is to achieve something. But if there are goals in your life, Cindy, I think maybe you've already described it to us, that if we get involved in this practice, then it clarifies for us our goals and the process we need to go through to get there.
I think that's right. And yoga it's not anti-goal setting. It just teaches us some skills to move closer to goals in a way where we get less caught up in results and we're more in, as you just so eloquently stated, Richard, the process.
Yeah.
Process is where we find the fruit.
Is there a danger in getting too involved in the process as opposed to becoming part of the process?
Well, I mean, you've heard the term navel gazer. You could just stare at your belly and meditate on that all day and not accomplish anything in life. And I don't think that's actually what the yogis intended either.
Right.
It is an inward journey, but for a greater purpose,
right,
so that we can show up in the world in a better way.
So some action is required, obviously, in order for us to evolve, to move forward. Are you optimistic about where our species is going as far as the work that you are trying to put out there to get other folks to be involved in. Are you optimistic about our future?
I would say I'm a skeptical optimist. It is definitely my nature to be optimistic, and I am surrounded daily by students and fellow teachers who are looking to grow, to shed that which isn't serving them, and to give to the world. But I say I'm skeptical because I think we're just globally in somewhat of a precarious state, maybe more so than we've been in my lifetime in terms of just threats to the planet, threats to civility, even within our own political dialogue. So I've got a healthy dose of skepticism, I would say.
Mm. I've heard it said, too. So I was chatting with someone about the what's been referred to as, and I can't remember when they instituted it, but it's been many decades ago, the doomsday clock, and how they say, you know, okay, it's 10 minutes to midnight, and now it's 5, and it's 3, and it's 1. And I was joking, saying, oh, no, it's 11:59:59 and 9/10 of a second. And they said, oh, no, it's already 12:02. And I'm going, really? It's that bad, is it? Okay. Well, then what are you still doing here, and why am I still here?
Right. I'll never stop doing the work and being hopeful and optimistic and trying to bring out the best in other people, because we all do have a personal best. That's the work, that's the journey, and I've seen it bear fruit, and I'm sure I will continue to see it bear fruit.
Oh, and to that, let me ask you then, what kind of changes have you seen firsthand specifically from the work that you've been doing, both with yourself, but also with the people that you have been associating with?
A very mundane example in my own life is my behavior when I'm driving a car. I tend toward the very impatient and reactive, and through my work, I am a much more pleasant driver on the road. So you'd like me a lot better now than you would have 15 years ago if you happened to drive by me, or God forbid, not go as fast as I wanted you to go and I was behind you. So from the mundane to, I've had students tell me that the yoga and meditation practice has healed them from past trauma, has helped them assess current relationships they're in and either make skillful choices to get out if said relationships aren't serving them, or to be more loving and let the relationship bloom if it is working out for them. So I think from the mundane to the profound, I've seen so much fruit from the practice.
By the way, in light of your wonderful advancements in driving etiquette, I will share with you something someone shared with me, because when I moved to Santa Barbara, and a little quick background, in 1996, I received a lens implant in my right eye. Prior to that, I was legally blind, and I was then able to drive after that lens implant. So the next thing I know, we're moving from Phoenix to Santa Barbara. And, of course, I've been driving here now for a little over 11 years. And when I first moved here, it was fine. And then over the course of the next few years, I started to get really irritated about people doing stupid stuff. Someone finally shared with me that guy in the blue Honda that just cut you off or did whatever they did in front of you did not wake up this morning saying, "Let's get Richard." It is not personal. And now, on the one hand, okay, all right, it's not personal. They're totally oblivious to my existence. All right, I can deal with that. But on the other hand, it's not personal. They're totally oblivious to my existence. What is their problem? I'm right here. Yeah. That dichotomy. But the bottom line is, when you're out there, it isn't personal. They're just not. They're not mindful, if I'm coining that phrase, they're not mindful of what they're really doing, and that is driving a car on the roadway with a bunch of other people.
Yeah.
I do have to give the universe an enormous amount of credit for keeping us all safe, because if you were to tally up the number of vehicles that are on the roadways across this country alone, and then figure out what the percentage of those cars that end up in accidents or incidents in just morning rush hour across the country, it's minute by comparison to the number of cars. We should have more accidents based upon the volume of cars and stupid actions.
Right.
But we don't.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It really is. And so I'm very thankful. Very thankful indeed.
That's a great perspective.
I'm also very thankful for your time and energy in sharing with us here on this program. I greatly appreciate it. And I would encourage people to definitely go to your website, which once again is yogaforyourbesthealth.com. Pick up a copy of the book Radiate, Using the Practice of Yoga to Cultivate Your Inner Shine. Learn about the eight limbs, the chakra centers, et cetera, et cetera. Make it happen, or hey, just remember that the divine is amongst the pots and the pans, or whatever it is that you work amongst. And I want to invite you, should you ever find yourself out here in the, you know, if you want to travel westward from Cleveland to Santa Barbara, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation. I mean, you never know. Maybe we'll do a short, you know, 5 or 10 minute yoga session.
Oh, my goodness. What an offer. I may take you up on that, Richard. Thank you.
Before we let you go, one final question, or actually three final questions. And again, thank you. And our listeners, if you would like to support this broadcast, that would be greatly appreciated, folks. Just go to the richarddugan.com homepage or mission page and scroll down to the PayPal link if you can do that. And hey, we'll take energetic support as well. We're not picky. We're certainly needing support for the financial upkeep of the broadcast, but it's not anything that is going to cause this program to go away. I would never do that to you. If I can't afford to put it on the broadcast, on the air, it won't be there, but we'll have podcasts. But if you can support us, hey, please do so in any way, shape, or form that that you wish. We're not going to put any expectations on that. Final three questions for you, Cindy, are: who is Cindy Warren?
Well, that's a tough question. I'm not quite sure how to answer that. I guess right now I'm an author, and I'm a mom and a wife and a lawyer and a yogi and someone just trying to live her best life.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
To share the beauty of the practice in as accessible yet deep way as I can.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
To help people find their inner shine, which sounds a little corny, but to find their self-love, to recognize that they're worth everything there is already, and to spread that with as many people as possible.
Well, again, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time, and I encourage people to pick up a copy of Radiate, Using the Practice of Yoga to cultivate your inner shine, and encourage people to go to your website again, which is yogaforyourbesthealth.com. We will be linked to your website as well. And again, thank you for joining us.
It's been an honor. Thanks so much, Richard.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, namaste and love to love.